So last week, to begin our study, we studied the just looking at the word discipline and what is discipline, and I thought we would start by just looking at our conclusion slide that we ended with. I added a few things, a line in this since last week, just to kind of recap where we left off, and then we'll begin with our study this week. So we're studying this, this study of discipline, church discipline. We're studying this because we desire to know and understand and follow God's plan for church discipline. That's why we have that attitude. That's why we're here, and we want to learn and we want to understand God's plan for discipline. We need discipline in our lives. And again, which goes along with the next line, is church discipline doesn't always mean to withdraw from the disorderly. Discipline in itself is the idea of training or educating one another, warning each other, admonishing one another, and even ourselves, teaching and training ourselves, self-control. There's discipline in that. We need discipline in our lives. Discipline is carried out in two ways, instructive and corrective. And remember that from last week. The instructive side is the teaching, the educating, the many things that go along with that. And then there's the corrective side, the admonishing, the warning when that is necessary. And when you think of disciplining our children, we might think of a punishment, an actual, you know, a spanking or something of that, the corrective nature of discipline. Two ways, instructive and corrective. Spiritual discipline is simply teaching and instructing us in God's word and his ways, and correcting us when we go astray from the truth. And also really highlighting the word truth in there, because everything this is all centered around the truth. It's all about God's laws. And when we violate God's laws, discipline needs to come in. And again, it's all centered around the truth. And then there is a way to carry out God's plan for church discipline. So let's seek his ways to do this. And that's what we're striving to do, is to understand his ways and understand, you know, what his plan is for church discipline. So before we move on, does anybody have any questions or any thoughts in relation to our study last week on just defining the word discipline and what is discipline? Anybody want to add to it? So I wanted to think for a minute of our title, which comes from our book. So saving the erring, the church, our families, and ourselves. And then down to the bottom it says a study of church discipline. And the slide's going to come up again, because I want us to really try to wrap our minds around what the purpose of church discipline is. And as we talked about last week, when we see the phrase church discipline, what do we think of, John? What do we think of? We've got a church discipline to deal with.
Correcting withdrawal,
the
negative side of it.
Exactly. There's a negative side of this that we ought to think of. And just like we had looked at our definitions last week, and we're going to look at here again, we see that it's so much more than just the withdrawal side, or the corrective side, the negative side, as people might say, even though when you think about it, there really isn't a lot of negative in the correction, is there? That's actually positive when you think about it. So when we punish our children, then we have to take a corrective action against our children. Okay, they think it's negative. But think of what you're doing. Think of what you're doing. You're training them. You're teaching them. Such as this first definition here. Now last week we looked at definitions from the American Heritage Dictionary, and that's what Donnie Rader had in his book. These definitions come from Strong. They're very similar. I just wanted to look at them from another point of view. So again, from Strong, the whole, and I just took bits and pieces. There was a lot in there in Strong. The whole training and education of children, which relate to the cultivating of mind and morals, and employees for this purpose now commands and admonitions, now reproof and punishment. It also includes the training and care of the body. So when we think of the corrective side discipline of our children, yes, they did something wrong, and we're trying to correct them. We're trying to cultivate their mind. We'll see later on in these definitions the idea of chastising them or molding them is what I meant to say. To be instructed or taught to learn, to cause one to learn. To chastise with blows, the father punishing his son. That's a vivid picture of corrective side. And I say this again, we've got some more to look at, but we think of church discipline as being negative, but we've got to get our mind wrapped around the concept that it's not. It's really not. Because of what we're trying to accomplish. Right, and that goes back to the slide of the title of our book. To chastise or castigate with words, or to correct, of those who are molding the character of others by reproof or admonition. I keep wanting to talk with all of these. I need to just let the slides speak for themselves. And admonishing, to warn, exhort, caution, or reprove gently. A calling to soundness of mind, to moderation and self-control. These are the ideas of what is a discipline. This is what discipline is. And again, what's the point? What's the point to study the topic? And that goes back to the title of our book. Because we're seeking to help save the erring, those who are going astray, the church, our families, and ourselves. That's what we're seeking to do. So as we're going through this study, not just tonight, but the course of this study, that's what we're seeking to do. We're seeking to save ourselves, to help save those who are erring from the truth, the church, and our families. Any questions or thoughts or anything anybody wants to add to any of that I've mentioned before we jump into our lesson? So personal offenses tonight. This is lesson 2, so chapter 2 in our book. Most of this material comes straight from the book. And I just got it here on the slide just so we can have a good flow of our class. So personal versus public offenses. So next week, I'm not convinced we're going to get through this class tonight. So maybe part of next week. But our next lesson is focused on public offenses. Well, this lesson is on personal offenses. I want to take a moment with this slide and see a distinction between the two, because it's important. It's really important, especially as we get, we're going to be reading and studying from Matthew chapter 18 this evening. There's a big difference between a personal offense and a public offense. And we all know this. I'm preaching to the choir here. Personal versus public. Let's just open it up for discussion here. So what are some of the differences? I don't know, maybe if that's, there's a lot of differences, and your mind might be thinking different things, but what comes to mind? Personal versus public. What might be a personal one? What might be a public offense? Maybe specific or generic? Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Well, offense being sin in this context, a personal sin is, when you think of personal, then that's kind of, even in its strictest sense, could be something I personally did that nobody even knows.
Exactly.
Nobody else except God knows. Mm-hmm. That would be a personal offense. Mm-hmm. I know that's not what this chapter is about.
Yep.
But it does carry the idea of private.
Yes.
You know, it's as opposed to public.
Exactly. Yeah, and that the first thing I have is it's personal offense is not public. It's private. It's personal. It's not public. and that's key to remember as we go through this study. What's a personal offense? A personal offense within our context, without giving the answer away, just to get our minds thinking.
One person sinning against another.
Yeah. So, exactly. So it's when one sins against another. That what we're talking about here is a personal offense. Public offense, we could just keep going along with that same logic. So a public offense is a sin that's not a personal offense. In the sense that a sin against another person, right? We're going to look at a few examples of these, not getting into the public too much because it's not the point of our study, but it helps to kind of get all these things out on the table when we're trying to understand the personal versus the public. So a public is a sin that's not personal. A public offense is not a sin between you and another person, but a sin committed in a public manner. And these are things taken from the book, Forsaking the Assembly, Adultery, or Drinking of Alcohol. There were other things listed. I think there were two or three other things that were listed in them. Those are ideas of what a public offense would be. There's many other things, and we're going to look more at that in our study on public offenses. Go ahead, John.
I'm not sure if confused is the word. But you're talking about public offense, and it's not necessarily offense against someone, it's just a sin that someone knows about, or the whole congregation someone knows about. But the personal offense, we're saying a sin against another person, Larry brought up, it could just be, you know, God knowing about it. But would also a personal offense be, say, I'm doing something that's sinful and I shouldn't be doing it, and you know about it, it's offensive to you that I'm doing it, would that be a personal offense too? Not that it's against you, but it's something that's would be offensive to you because you know I'm doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be interesting to discuss that when we get into the public side, because I tend to put that more on the public side. I do believe that there's some crossover with some of those things, and we've got to use judgment in deciding where an offense like that might go. Typically, like when we think of like forsaking the assembly or adultery, even though the adultery was a personal offense to the spouse, but it's very public too, right, in nature. Assembly, forsaking the assembly. We might know of a person, you know, within the congregation that's forsaking the assembly, but it's public in nature. And I guess maybe it would just depend on specifically what you might think of. Larry, you thought? Oh, your hand was slowly going up.
I guess I'm just thinking if you know, Bob commits is living in sin and everything, or is involved in sin, but nobody knows about it except Jim. Then Jim it's obviously it's not private anymore because someone besides Bob knows. Mm-hmm. But does Jim? I know in a later discussion.
Yeah.
Does Jim should? It seems to me that the just generally through the New Testament the teaching of something that's still private that he's aware of should be handled as privately as possible.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
As private as it is.
Yes.
And then, but that's not what you're talking about in this public offense here.
No.
This is something people are aware of.
Aware of. Exactly. And that's a good way
to one person aware of this thing, or even two people are aware of this. Wouldn't they want to deal with that with him?
Yeah.
And nice and supply. Well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's a good way to word it, too. It's something that's very known to others within the public. I was thinking of language that wasn't something I had on a slide here, but maybe filthy language, and it's just the talk, the way they talk in the workplace. I mean, it's very, and then we hear it, you know, then that's something that would be public.
when you got in our car accident when the guy ran the stop sign, he ran it really fast. He was going approximately 70 miles an hour. I thought we were very fortunate to come out of there alive, besides walking. And inside the car, I let a word fly out. Now, to me, that was a private, personal thing that I needed to ask for forgiveness for. But I also got out of the car and, you know, chose another bad word to use out loud and then asked the cops to go ahead and just shoot them all. You know, now I've made it a public thing, because now I've made a scene outside where other people heard, you know, and, you know, the next Sunday, you know, I asked for the forgiveness. I told our congregation about it and what had happened and what I had said and done. You know, so there I thought I took a personal sin and turned it into a public sin by my reactions.
Guy?
I don't know. Okay. Keep going. Okay.
All right. Any other thoughts, John? Let's keep going. Keep your thoughts. Let's go ahead and turn to Matthew 18, and let's read through this. I'd like to go ahead and read the chapter in its entirety. It's a little lengthy, but to get the context of what Jesus is speaking of, and we put all of these things together, and it, which we're not necessarily going to put them together. If you read one of the first paragraphs in, I'm sure you have preparing for the class in lesson two, it speaks of kind of how it all fits together. But we'll read it together, and then we're going to focus on basically the first 17 verses of the chapter. So Matthew 18 verse 1, at that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called and he called a child to himself and set him before them and said, "Truly I say to you, unless you are converted and become like children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it is better for him that a heavy millstone be hung around his neck and that he be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to that man through whom the stumbling block comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than having two hands or feet to be cast into the eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than having two eyes to be cast into the fiery hell. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that the angel in heaven continually behold the face of my Father who is in heaven, for the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. What do you think? If any man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountains and go and search for the one that is strayed? And if it turns out that he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 which have not gone astray. Thus it is not the will of a Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. And if your brother sins, go and reprove him in private, and if he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax gatherer. Truly I say to you, whatever you shall bind on earth, shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again I say to you that if two of you agree on earth about anything that they may ask, and it shall be done for them by my Father who is in heaven. For where two or three have gathered together in my name, there I am in their midst. Then Peter came and said to him, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me, and I forgive him? Up to seven times? Jesus said to him, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times 7. For this reason the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a certain king who wished to settle an account with his slaves. And when he began to settle them, there was brought to him one who owed him 10,000 talents. But since he did not have the means to repay, his lord commanded him to be sold along with his wife and children and all that he had, and repayment to be made. The slave therefore, falling down, prostrating himself before him, saying, have patience with me, and I will repay you everything. And the Lord of the slave felt compassion and released him and forgave him the debt. But that slave went out and found one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii, and seized him and began to choke him, saying, pay back what you owe. So his fellow slave fell down and began to entreat him, saying, have patience with me, and I will repay you. He was unwilling, however, but went and threw him into prison until he should pay back what was owed. So when his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were deeply grieved and came and reported to their Lord all that had happened. Then summoning him, his Lord said to him, you wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you entreated me. Should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave, even as I have mercy on you? And his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he should repay all that was owed him. So shall my heavenly Father also do to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from your heart. And so when you look at, when you put it all together, you get this idea of I keep wanting to go back to my slide, to the title of our book. I mean, that's what we're living for. We're living for heaven, and we're living to help each other get to heaven. And when it comes down, as we get into these personal and public offenses and things that we've done wrong, maybe tonight, as we talk about toward another person, but we're not willing to forgive another, or our pride is callousing our heart, and we can't move past that to see the truth. Like he said in verse 35, if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. And so, anyway, it comes back to that, comes back to your heart, and where, just what our attitude is toward these things, toward our Father in heaven, toward wanting to go to heaven, toward our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. What's our natural response when someone does something wrong to us? So we've been offended, right? We've been sinned against. Typically, maybe I shouldn't even say typically, but what's a natural reaction? Whether it's right or wrong, I'm just saying, just how do we react to some of those things?
Want to get even.
Say it again.
Want to get even.
Okay. Yes. Anybody
Go
else?
To someone else about it.
Go to someone else about it. Yep. Talk to someone else. Sure.
To get mad or angry.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. To be upset, to despise them, which is goes along with verse 10 here in Matthew chapter 18. See to it that you do not despise one of these little ones. And this, to despise others, to think against, to esteem, literally to think down on, with the assumption of superiority, to have contempt for another. These are definition pulled from Strong's. To think against. Let me look ahead here for a second. I think our pride gets hurt, depending on what the sin is, depending on what it is. But we get, like Troy said, we get angry. We get angry. We get disappointed in what has been done. And so it's easy to have this idea of despising them, as Jesus talked about here in verse 10, to have contempt for another person. Obviously, that's not the attitude that we should have. That's where it takes self-control. It might discipline, right, to ourselves to not want to react this way, but rather react or act the way that God tells us to act. And we see specific instructions here in Matthew chapter 18 in verses 15 through 17. But there's still an attitude that we have toward the other person. And that's what I guess I want us to see and to really think about, to not want to despise them and not to think low of them. They did something wrong to us. You know, how dare you? Where, again, different sins are going to, we're going to respond to different sins differently. But we're not to look down on them for those things. What are some examples of sins against another person? What comes to mind? Specific sins. So you've been sinned against. What are some of those sins that can be done to you that would call for us, you know, like our context here in Matthew 18, to go to them? So we've been sinned against. What are some of those sins? What could some of those things be? John.
I think one of the major ones is someone talking behind someone's back, which is what all this is about, is we go to that person, not talk to someone else. We go to the person. A lot of times we don't, but talk to someone else about it.
Yeah.
I think that's a sin in itself. It's kind of like a reversal on the other side. If someone sends you to you, that person sending it back because you're doing something even as wrong.
He's like gossip. Yeah. Okay.
Lie.
Yep.
What was that? Curse.
Outburst of anger. I was thinking maybe being in a situation with someone and just getting overly upset at them like that. Yeah, my fists go up, or just we didn't conduct ourselves properly, and we overstep. You know, the Bible tells us be angry but don't sin. But there's a point that we cross that line, and that's what I'm speaking of here. Outbursts of anger. Another one is unforgiveness. And this might be a little further down the road, but I did something wrong to my brother Larry, and maybe he's come to me, or maybe I've gone to him and say, hey, I'm sorry, and he won't forgive me. He's got a grudge now against me, or something like that. So now we you know, the process is kind of flipped, and now we have an issue because of an unforgiving heart within it. Any other examples or any other things you can think of that would be sinned against another person?
Stealing from someone.
Stealing. I mean, okay.
Maybe we don't think of those kind of things happening very often, but I knew of a case back home where a man was embezzling from the business of another member of the church there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Thessalonians, Paul talks about defrauding one another sexually, basically. I mean, mm-hmm. all kinds of sexual immorality could even occur.
Yeah. Okay. In Matthew 18, let's read verses 15 through 17 again as we get into this. If your brother sinned against you, it is against you. I am reading from the New American Standard version, and I'll, let's see, Joel, what version do you have? I'm going to ask you to read this after I do, if you don't mind. 15, if your brother sins, go and reprove him in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax gatherer. So Joel, go ahead and read 15 through 17.
Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word would be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector.
So in the New King James Version, the King James Version, the American Standard Version, basically every version except the New American Standard, uses the word you. So it basically qualifies that sin as who it committed against. So if your brother sins, even though you could say even by the context what it is, but it's just interesting that all the other versions out there says, and if your brother sins against you, and I think that's important because it qualifies what we're talking about here, and we're talking about personal offenses. Okay. Okay. Who committed the sin? Based on our context, who committed the sin?
Your brother.
So, your brother against you. And it's fair to say that because we're the ones we've been sinned against. And maybe you're the one that sinned, but anyway, we're going to look at it from the standpoint of we've been sinned against. So our brother sinned against you. Is the sin in this context public or private? It's private. Okay. So then what is the instruction? This is just generally speaking to get started on this. What is the instruction for the one who has been sinned against? So we've been sinned against, then go to. That's right. Go to him in private and reprove him. So that's the instruction that is given, to go to him in private. Okay, what should we not do? You said one earlier. Say it again.
Go talk to other people.
Go talk to others. And the question I asked before is what the natural thing to do, and we go talk to, you know, another brother, or we go talk to someone else. Hey, you won't believe what this person did to me, or whatever it is. What else should we not do? We should not go to him. Yes, that's big. It's a personal matter. It's a personal matter. What should we not do?
Make it public.
That's right. Make it public. And that kind of goes along with what Larry said about going and talking to others first. Because that then makes it public. Even then, it could still not be totally public, but it's well on its way. Right? You've got the chain of gossip starting now. And whatever else you might want to call it.
Chris,
go ahead.
If you do make it public, are you not then sinning?
I would say yes, based on this context here, and we'll get into that as we keep going. through, and that would be, just in a nutshell, it would be a violation of our instructions, because the instruction says, right, and we'll get into that. So, yeah, Troy.
Well, a private sin, we ask the Lord for forgiveness. You know, if I sin against you and it's just between the two of us, then I ask you for the forgiveness. You know, if I've made it a public sin, now I need to come forward and let the entire congregation know what I have done and ask for forgiveness of the entire congregation. Do I not? On a public sin, I believe we need to come forward and ask for forgiveness. Or on a private sin, it's between the two of us and the Lord.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. John.
Another thing I think we could put under what should we not do, and that would be just to hold it in and not go to that person.
Mm-hmm.
The scriptures say to go to them, so if you don't go to them.
That's right. That's right, yeah. Yeah, like Larry said, don't. Yeah, well, yeah, that's another way of saying it. Yeah, no, it's good to not, and that's another tendency. Is we hold it in. I like that. We hold that in. Despise him. That's another thing. As we looked at earlier, we should not look down upon them. We should not despise them. We should not hold contempt for them. Whatever, we need to. Remember what we're doing, why we're doing what we're doing, not just the discipline, but life, and we're trying to make it to heaven, and someone sinned. I mean, okay, it gets personal because they sinned against you, and we get all bent out of shape over it because, man, you, how can you do, we gotta stop. That's not, we're taking it too personal, okay? Oh yes, they sinned against that, that's personal. But we've got to remember the bigger picture. They've sinned, okay? And we're going to look at that in a couple slides. They've sinned, all right? And we go to our class on Wednesday night. What is sin? They've sinned. They've sinned. We should not despise them for that. We should want to help them and move forward with that. Okay. Does the context in verses 15 through 17, Matthew 18, does the context of verses 15 through 17 support instructions for handling a public offense?
In 17, it gets to the point that you tell the church and it does become public.
Yes.
So it would be a public offense after that, at that last stage.
But it starts out at the offense is a private. It's a personal offense. That's right. And yeah, and that was my thought on this. And I'd be curious if anybody has any thoughts. The instructions are specific to a private offense. In verse 15, if your brother sins against you, and then it goes on from there, and it has three different steps in essence as to what you do if a brother sins against you. So with the private personal offense. I've seen it where we've been in situations where it was a public offense, but we've used Matthew 18 as a guideline, basically for that. After studying this, looking at it more, I think we need to stay away from Matthew 18 if it's a public offense. That's my thought. I think there's some wisdom here, but we're going to see in our next lesson, if you haven't read it already, about public offenses, there is very specific instructions of how to go about a public sin, someone who has sinned in a public manner. Anybody have any thoughts? Any thoughts on any of that? Go ahead, John.
I'm still a little confused because if it starts out as a private offense, I mean, I agree with that 100%, but then in the end, like I said, it goes public because it goes to the church, and that's how you treat them afterwards. So, I mean, it seems like it's got a combination of both there. And maybe I'm reading it wrong.
Yeah. One And I didn't prepare to talk about this. One of the and maybe this isn't fair to read this in defending the answer here, my question here, but in 1 Timothy 5, and there's several examples regarding a public offense. There's examples of offenses, and then there's instructions for dealing with the offenses, more than there is a private or personal. But in 1 Timothy 5, speaking of, he said, let elders who, in verse 17, let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who work hard at preaching and teaching. The scripture says you should not muzzle the ox while he is threshing, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. Do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses. Those who continue in sin, rebuke in the presence of all, so that the rest may be fearful of sinning. And so there's different instructions there, where it seems that, and that's why I wonder, and I'm not exactly sure of this, I wonder if, depending on the sin, Larry mentioned one, not a specific sin, but you know of a person that's sinning, did you say that? Maybe it's, I don't know. We know of a person that's sinning. They didn't sin against us, they're just sinning. But we go to them, right? We go to them in private. I suppose it kind of depends on the sin. I guess it depends on the sin. And I'm seeking to have a discussion here if you guys have any thoughts on that, on this, but just kind of thinking as we go through this. Matthew 18 is not dealing with a public offense. I mean, that, we can't get around that. It, like you say, it becomes public, but the sin was not public. The sin was personal. Troy, he did wrong to me. He lied to me about something. I went to him. He said, no, dude, you're wrong. I didn't... I'm like, but you... I'm going down the line, okay. It's not public. And eventually it becomes public, but only because the guy wouldn't listen to, you know, to the instruction for the personal, personal offense. And maybe that's really all I'm trying to say. This is instruction for a personal offense, not a public offense. I believe that, as I said, I believe we can use some wisdom in what's going on here. But we're going to see in our next lesson that when a public sin was made, they were rebuked in the presence of all. I mean, it was like step number one. Our next slide is step number one for personal offense. Well, step number one that we're going to see throughout the New Testament was they were rebuked in the presence of others, and because it was a public offense. And Ananias and Sapphira was kind of the same thing. Anybody, any thoughts on that? Go ahead, Sean.
You know, like you were saying, you know, if we can keep it between just you and I, the longer we can keep it between just you and I trying to work this out, I think it's better for all of us, you know, and till the point that we cannot work on it any further, then, you know, then we bring a referee into our battle, right? I mean, one of the most knee-jerk reactions we have is when you come to me saying I'm doing something wrong, is for me to get defensive. You know, I mean, right away, our defenses go up and we start trying to deflect. You know, and we have to remember that, you know, this is a Christian brother who would not come at us in that way. You know, they're only coming to us because they love us and they want to help us. You know, and try and not get that defensive, deflective thing, part of us out right away, you know, and listen to all the words and try and take that look in the mirror and see for yourself. Is this guy telling me the truth?
Yeah.
You know, that is so hard for us to see ourselves. You know, and one of the biggest conversations she and I have is, you know, tone of voice. You know, is it in a good tone or is it in a yippee tone? You know, and that's just one of those things that we have, you know, especially when you have a spouse and you guys are together so much and you're retired and nobody's working anymore and we're spending that much more time together. But it is, you know, facial expressions and tone of voice is a lot to do with how we are going to respond to somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, Lou.
So if you're aware of someone, you don't know whether it's you alone who are aware of it, but you're aware of someone doing sinning in a public way, not publicly here among us, but publicly out there, it's something, then, I mean, maybe we'll be addressing that as we go through these chapters, but is there some wisdom and is there a principle here that you go to that person, that person alone?
Yeah.
Now, the fact that they have sinned publicly, maybe that needs a public confession because it's out there or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just trying to
determine
the difference between making something public to the congregation, and maybe this is all going to be clarified as we go.
Exactly. And I think as we get into the public side and we're looking at some of the examples, I guess that's what, you know, as I was reading through lesson 3, the instructions are very different. They're very different of how to handle a public sin versus a personal sin. Yeah.
So this being a personal sin against someone, the public is a public, is just generally a public sin. It may be against a lot of people, or it may be against none of these people.
Exactly.
That's all we're saying?
Yeah. Troy, did you have a thought, and Denise?
Well, I was thinking, we always refer to it that a public sin is giving Jesus a black eye. We're giving our congregation, you know, if I walk around saying bad words constantly and they say, that man calls himself a man of Christ, he's a godly man and he's talking like that, well, I've embarrassed the entire congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've embarrassed Jesus and I've given him a black eye because I'm not representing us in a decent manner.
Yeah. Denise?
I was thinking the same along the same lines. It truly depends on the sin. You can, you know, eat meat, not eat meat. If it offends your brother, then I don't do it in front of my brother. But I can eat meat. It's just I don't do it in front of. I don't eat pork with a 7-day Adventist.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I can't eat pork, but I don't want to purposely offend them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It depends on what the sin is.
Yeah, I think so too. Let's think on these things this week. We're not going to finish. We've got about 7 minutes left. We won't finish our class, and so kind of chew on those thoughts and do some studying. And if you have any thoughts or questions, and we'll talk about this specific idea as far as Matthew 18 being an example to you that as a pattern for a public offense. That's the question. Can we use Matthew 18:15-17 as a pattern, biblical pattern, for addressing a public offense? Okay. So there's three approaches to handling a personal offense here in Matthew 18:15-17. The first approach we read in verse 15, if your brother sins against you, go and reprove him in private, and if he listens to you, you have won your brother. The instruction, the first approach is, like we said, we go to him, right? That's what we said a few slides back. That's what we do. The offender goes to the offender, right? Just using the words that we're reading in our book. Troy sinned against me. I go to him. Okay, we see that. That's the instruction. Okay, inform him of his sin against you. So I inform him of his sin against me. We're just reading verse 15, just putting it in our own words. It's an attempt to keep the matter private since it's between you and him. So whatever it is we've got between him and I, I'm going to go to him. I'm not going to go to Larry. I'm not going to go to Joel or John. I'm not going to say, God, you don't believe. No, I'm going to go to him. We're going to keep this private, as private as we can. If he listens, you have won your brother. That's the whole idea. So there's this reproving him. Joel, what's the word again in the King James?
Where?
Say it again.
Where?
What?
What verse?
Oh, 15, sorry.
15, moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his faults between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother.
So just tell him. And so this is the, again, this definition of discipline, to chastise, castigate with words, to correct. So that's kind of this idea. Admonishing, to warn, exhort, caution, reprove gently, a calling to soundness of mind, moderation, self-control. So that's what's going on here in verse 15. That's what we're doing. We're reproving. We're warning him, exhorting him. Calling to soundness of mind, however you want to say it. You're trying to highlight that sin. We're going to him saying, hey, this is what the scriptures say. And it might be, yeah, you know, you did this to me, but we need to take God's word with us. That's more than anything. We need to say, you know, here, you did this. Bible says don't do this. Bible says don't lie or don't whatever. You know, you stole from me. You stole my stuff. The Bible says don't do that. We'll call into soundness of mind. Why are we supposed to do this? Again, we. Just for sake of time, I'll run through this. We brought this up a lot this evening, not because we're upset or they upset us or hurt our feelings, but because of our love for them and in their salvation. Goes to the title of our class and what we're studying here. Satan was trying to help save each other, and again, they sin. They sin meaning what? They sin. It's not, like I said, it's not because he hurt my feelings. He sinned. We get more bent out of shape over our feelings than we do the fact that someone actually sinned against us, but it's against God ultimately. And what does that mean? What does that mean? They sin. Troy, what?
You're lost.
You're lost. Separated from God. Eternally lost if they're not restored. I brought up Acts chapter 8. Example of Simon, right? I mean, he, in Acts chapter 8, not reading this whole thing, we know the story. He saw that, verse 18, that the Spirit was bestowed through the laying on of the apostles' hands. He wanted to do that. And then they said, verse 21, 20, may you sober purpose with you because you thought you could obtain the gift of God with money. You have no portion, part or portion in this matter, for your heart is not right before God. Did he sin? He didn't sin. He's fine. No, I mean, he sinned. He sinned. It's not right before God. Therefore, repent. Why is he telling him these things? Why would Peter say, repent of this wickedness of yours and pray that the Lord, that if possible, the intention of your heart may be forgiven you. For I see that you in the gall of bitterness and the bondage of iniquity. Simon said, pray that the Lord yourselves, that none of what you said comes upon me. I mean, he sinned. And I get the picture. We talked about this when we were there in our Acts class. But if he hadn't prayed, I mean, he's lost. And Peter is saying, hey, the apostles, you're separated from God. You're eternally lost over one sin. Yes, Simon, one sin. He was lost, and he needed to pray to the God that the intentions of his heart would be forgiven over one sin. So that's why when someone sins against us, we take the matter seriously. Like Larry said, we go to them. We actually go. Don't just, like John said, we just get over it. It's not that big a deal. He didn't mean it.
So what if you don't go? Is that not a sin?
It's a lack of concern and a lack of love for your brother.
But if you're going to go and you don't go, is that the sin of omission?
Yeah, I mean, the instructions to go. Go. It's the same word that was used back in Matthew 28. Go into all the world. And there's a responsibility that we have. And that's, your point is good. Go ahead.
What if you just forgive?
Say it again.
What if you just... I have a girlfriend. Anytime something happens, she just automatically, like, I forgive you, it's done, it's over. Does that everyone? Is that simple?
Yeah, we need to. What's interesting is people say that we're unloving. A person is unloving if you go to someone and say, you know, hey, I don't appreciate the way that you got mad at me the other day, and you said some things you shouldn't have said. And that gets labeled as unloving, and we see as we go through that true Bible love is what we're talking about. It's an attempt to save other people and to help them get to heaven. Go ahead.
Bible says go. If you don't do what the Bible's telling you, then in my book it's a sin. I believe it to be a sin if you don't follow the instructions that are left to us in the Bible.
I think it would be, we'll end here, and we'll pick up on our second approach next week. But we've got this idea of reproving one another. Even reprove is kind of a harsh word, but it really shouldn't be. I mean, it's serious, but we get it built up in our mind that they're going to hate me, right? I'm going to lose my friend because I went to John and I said, hey, you know, you did this to me, and maybe you didn't mean to, but, and I get this fear built up within me, which causes me to not go. Because I'm scared of what. So we, back in the beginning, you know, in our conclusions from last week, is there is a way to carry out God's plan for these things. And when we desire to know what God's plan is, then we ought to have the desire to actually carry it out. It doesn't do any good to know something but not to actually follow through with it. So I think that's a problem that we get, oftentimes we'll get in our mind. We just build up this this anxiety wall that I can't go because I'm too scared of what the outcome might be. But if we believe God, God says discipline is actually a good thing, and reproving is a good thing, admonishing is a very good thing. Get over the fact that maybe you were offended a little bit and try to help each other out. And like Troy said earlier, when we as the offender have that attitude as well, then we're all in this together. We're all in this together. None of us are out to get each other. We think that the other person is going to be out to get us when we go talk to them, but we need to get over that fact. Trust and believe in God's way and God's plan. Really believe that His plan works. Not just for step number one or approach number one, but, you know, going all the way through these approaches, and we really believe Him, we'll see results. I believe we don't see results because we don't often believe that His plan actually works. So, no, I'm done with my thoughts. Does anybody else have any comments or anything they want to throw out there? Go ahead, Troy.
Possession is 99/10 of the law, and I have it now, so you'll have to prove it's yours.
Alright, next week we'll begin here. We're going to talk about the second and third approach, and we'll possibly move on to lesson three. So we're going to be letting a closing prayer, and then we'll be dismissed.